From the macabre minds of Laughing Devil Production comes another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind, amp up your imagination, and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted. The Samhain Compact by August Derleth. Now, I know that the strange and terrible happenings at Samhain House had their beginnings much further back than any of us then imagined, certainly farther back than Eldon or I thought at that time. Manifestly, there was no reason to suppose in those early weeks during which Asa Sanwin's time was running out that his trouble grew out of something in a past so remote as to be beyond our comprehension. It was only towards the end of the affair at Samhain House that terrible glimpses were afforded us, hints of something frightful and awful behind the commonplace events of everyday life broke through to the surface, and ultimately we were enabled to grasp briefly the heart of what lay beneath. Samhain House had originally been called Samhain by the Sea, but its later appellation had soon come to be far more convenient in use. It was an old-fashioned house, old as such houses were old in New England, standing along the Innsmouth Road not too far from Arkham, of two stories and an attic with a deep basement. The roof was many gabled with dormer windows rising from the attic. Before the house, old elms and maples stood. Behind, only a hedge of lilacs separated the lawn from the sharp descent to the sea. For the house stood on a high point of land somewhat removed from the highway itself. In appearance, it might have seemed a little cold to the casual passerby, but to me, it had always been colored by memories of childhood vacations spent there with my cousin Eldon. It represented relief from Boston, escape from the crowded city. Until the curious happenings that began in the late winter of 1938, I retained my early impression of Samhain House. Even so, it was not until after that strange winter's end that I became aware of how subtly, but certainly, Samhain House had changed from the haven of childhood summers to a malign harbor for incredible evil. My introduction to those curiously disturbing events was prosaic enough. It came in the shape of a telephone call from Eldon. I was about to sit down to supper with my fellow librarians of Arkham's Miskatonic University in the small club of which we were members. I took the call in the club's lounging room. "Dave, this is Eldon. I want you to run up for a few days." "Too busy, I'm afraid," I replied. "I'll try to make it next week." "No, no, now." "Dave, the owls are hooting." That was all. There was nothing more. I returned to the heated discussion in which I had been engaged when I was summoned to the telephone, and had actually picked up the threads of that discussion once more when what my cousin had said effected the necessary bridge into the years past. And instantly, I excused myself and left for my rooms to prepare for the journey to Samhain House. Long ago, almost 3 decades ago, in those carefree days of childhood play, there had been established between us a certain agreement. If ever one of us uttered a certain cryptic sentence, it was to be interpreted as a cry for assistance. To this we pledged ourselves. That cryptic sentence was, "The owls are hooting," and my cousin Eldon had spoken it. Within an hour, I had arranged for a substitute to take my place in the library of Miskatonic and was on my way to Samhain House, driving faster than the law permitted. Candidly, I was half amused, half frightened. The pledge, as we had made it in those days, was serious enough, but it was, after all, a fancy of childhood that Eldon had seen fit to utter now. That cryptic sentence seemed to me evidence of something seriously disturbing in his existence. It seemed to me now rather the last appeal of dire distress than any casual harking back to childhood. The night descended before I reached San Juan House. A chill night with frost. A light snow still covered the ground, but the highway was clear. The last few miles of San Juan House lay along the ocean, so that the drive was singularly beautiful, the moonlight making a wide path of yellow on the sea, and the wind rippling the water, so that the entire bosom of the sea sparkled and gleamed, as with some inner light. Trees, buildings, hill slopes, broke into the eastern horizon line from time to time, but lessened the sea's beauty not at all, and presently the large ungainly structure that was San Juan House broke into the skyline. San Juan House was dark, except for a thin line of light well towards the rear. Here Eldon lived alone with his father and an old servant, though a countrywoman or two came regularly to clean the house once or twice a week. I drove the car round to the one side where an old barn served as a garage, put the car away, took my bag, and made my way to the house. Eldon had heard me. I encountered him in the darkness just beyond the door. His long face touched a little with moonlight, his dressing gown held closely to his thin body. "I knew I could count on you, Dave," he said, taking my bag. "What's up, Eldon?" "Oh, don't say anything," he said nervously, as if someone might hear. "Wait, I'll tell you in time. And be quiet. Let's not disturb Father for the time being." He led the way into the house, going with extreme care down the wide hall towards the stairs, behind which his own rooms were. I could not help noticing the unnatural quiet of the house, and the sound of the sea beyond. It struck me then that the atmosphere was faintly eerie, but I shrugged away this feeling. In the light of his room, I saw that my cousin was seriously upset. Despite a false air of healthy welcome, my coming was clearly not an end, but only an incident. He was haggard. His eyes were dark and red-rimmed, as if he had not slept for some days, and his hands moved constantly in that excess of nervousness, so common to neurotics. "Now then, sit down, make yourself at home. You've had supper?" "Enough," I assured him, and waited for him to unburden himself. He took a turn or two about the room, opened the door cautiously, and looked out, before he came back to sit down beside me. "Well, it's about Father," he began without preamble. "You know how we've always lived without any visible income, and yet always seem to have money. That's been for several generations in the San Juan line, and I've never bothered my head about it. Last fall, however, money was running very low. Father said he needed to go on a journey, and he went. Father seldom travels, but I remembered then that the last time he traveled, almost 10 years ago, we were also in dire straits. But when he came back, there seemed again to be plenty of money. I never saw my father leave the house, and I never saw him come back. One day he was gone, another he was back. It happened the same way this time, and after he was back, there seemed again to be plenty of money available for our use." He shook his head, perplexed. "I confess to you that for some time thereafter, I looked through the transcript with utmost care on the lookout for some notice of robbery, but there was none." "Some business, perhaps?" I murmured. He shook his head. "But that isn't what worries me now. I could forget that if it weren't for the fact that it seems to have some connection with Father's present condition."
"Is he ill, then?"
"Why, yes and no. He isn't himself."
"What do you mean?"
"He isn't the father I knew. I can hardly explain myself, and naturally, I'm upset. I was aware of this for the first time when I learned he had returned and, pausing outside the door of his rooms, heard him talking to himself in a low guttural voice. 'I've tricked them,' he said to himself several times. There was more, of course, but at the moment I did not listen. I knocked on the door, whereupon he called out harshly and ordered me to return to my quarters until the following day.
Since that time he has been behaving with increasing queerness, and of late he has seemed to me definitely afraid of something or someone, I don't know which, and some unusual things have begun to take place.
What things? I asked bluntly.
Well, to begin with, the wet doorknobs.
Wet doorknobs? I exclaimed.
He nodded gravely. The first time Father saw them, he had old Ambrose and me on the carpet demanding to know which of us had gone through the house with wet hands. Of course, neither of us had. He dismissed us abruptly, and there was an end to that. But from time to time, a doorknob or two would show up wet, and Father began to be afraid of finding them so, developing a kind of apprehension I couldn't mistake for something else.
Go on.
Then there are, of course, the footsteps and the music. They seem to sound from the air or from the earth. Frankly, I don't know which. But there is something here I don't understand, and something of which Father is frankly afraid, so that he keeps more and more to his rooms. He doesn't come out sometimes for days, and when he does, walks with the air of a man momentarily expecting some enemy to pounce upon him, with his eyes for every stray shadow and movement, and no great concern for Ambrose or me or the women who come to clean, though he has not permitted any of these women in his rooms, preferring to keep them clean himself. What my cousin had said distressed me, not so much for my uncle's sake as for his own. Indeed, at the conclusion of his narrative, he was almost painfully upset, and I could neither treat what he had told me with the levity I had the impulse to do, nor with the gravity he seemed to think it merited. I preserved accordingly an interested impartiality. "I suppose Uncle Ass is still up," I said. "He'll be surprised to find me here, and you won't want him to know you've sent for me. So I rather think we'd better go on up now." My Uncle Asa was in every respect his son's opposite. While Eldon tended to be tall and thin, Asa was squat and heavy, not so much fat as muscular, with a short, thick neck and a curiously repellent face. He had scarcely any forehead. Thick, black hair grew only an inch above his bushy eyebrows, and a fringe of beard ran along his jaw, from one ear to the other. Though he wore no mustache, his nose was small, almost non-existent in contrast to eyes, so abnormally large, that a first glance from them invariably startled any beholder. In addition to the unnatural size of his eyes, their prominence was augmented by thick lens spectacles which he wore, for in later years his eyes had grown progressively weaker, and he found it necessary to consult an oculist every 6 months. His mouth, finally, was singularly wide and thin. It was not gross or thick-lipped, as one might have supposed it would be in one so squat and heavy, but its width was astonishing, for it was no less than 5 inches across, so that, what with the thick shortness of his neck and his deceptive fringe of beard, it was as if the line of mouth divided his head from his torso. He had a strangely Bactrian appearance, and already in our childhood we had nicknamed the Frog, because at that time he bore a facial resemblance to the creatures Alden and I often caught in the meadows and swamp across the highway inland from San Juan House. At the moment of our entrance to his upstairs study, Uncle Asa was bent over his desk, hunched in that aspect so natural to see. He turned at once, his eyes narrowed, his mouth partly opened. But almost instantly the aspect of sudden fear was gone. He smiled affably and shuffled away from his desk towards me, one hand outstretched. "Oh, good evening, David. I had thought to see you before Easter."
"I found I could get away," I replied, "so I came. Besides, I hear little from you and Eldon."
The old man flashed a quick glance at Eldon, and I could not help thinking that while my cousin looked older than he was, my uncle certainly looked less than the 60-odd years that were his.
He put out chairs for us and immediately engaged me in conversation about foreign affairs, a subject upon which I found him astonishingly well informed. The easy informality of his manner did much to offset the impression I had received from Eldon. Indeed, I was well on the way of thinking that some grave mental illness
had taken possession of Eldon when I received confirmation of my cousin's suspicions. In the middle of a sentence about the problem of European minorities, my uncle suddenly broke off with his head cocked a little to one side, as if he were listening for something, and an expression of mingled fear and defiance crossed his face. He seemed to have forgotten about us entirely, so completely was his absorption. For almost 3 minutes he sat in this manner, while neither Eldon nor I made any move whatever, beyond turning our heads a little in an effort to hear what he heard. At the moment, however, there was no telling to what he listened. The wind outside had risen, and the voice of the sea murmured and thundered along the shore. Beyond this rose the sound of some nocturnal bird, an uncanny undulation with which I was not familiar, and above us in the attic of the old house, a kind of rustling was constant, as if the wind were crying through an aperture somewhere into the room. For the duration of those 3 minutes, then, no one of us made a move, no one spoke. Then abruptly my uncle's face was contorted with rage. He leaped to his feet and ran to the one open window on the east, closing the window with such violence that I thought the glass must surely break, but it did not. For a moment he stood there, mumbling to himself. Then he turned and hurried back to us, his features as calm and affable as ever. "Well, good night, my boy. I have much work to do. Make yourself at home here, as always." He shook hands again, a little ceremoniously, and we were dismissed. Eldon said nothing until we reached his own room once more. Then I saw that he was trembling. He sat down weakly and held his head in his hands, murmuring, "You see, I told you how it was, and that's nothing." "Well, I don't think you need worry about it," I assured him. "In the first place, I'm familiar with any number of people who continue to work in their minds while carrying on conversations, and suddenly cease talking when ideas hit them with force. As to the episode of the window, I confess I cannot attempt to explain it, but..." "Oh, it wasn't my father," said Eldon suddenly. "It was the cry. The call from outside, that undulation." "I thought a bird," I answered lamely. "There's no bird that makes a sound like that. And the migration hasn't begun except for robins and bluebirds and killdeers." "It was that, I tell you, Dave. Whatever it is that makes that sound speaks to father." For a few moments, I was too surprised to answer. Not alone because of my cousin's sincerity, but because I could not deny that Uncle Asa had indeed conducted himself as if someone had spoken to him. I got up and took a turn about the room, glancing at Eldon from time to time, but it was evident that my cousin needed no belief of mine to confirm his own, so I sat down near him again. "If we assume that such is the case, Eldon, what is it that talks to your father?" "I don't know. I heard it first about a month ago. That time father seemed very frightened. Not long after, I heard it again. I tried to find out where it came from, but I could learn nothing. The second time, it seemed to come from the sea, as it did tonight. Subsequently, I was positive it came from above the house. And once, I could take oath it came from beneath the building. Shortly after that first time, I heard music, weird music, beautiful but evil. I thought I had dreamed it, because it induced in me a strange, fantastic dreams. Dreams of some place far from earth, and yet linked to earth by some demonic chain. I can't describe them with any degree of justice at all. At about the same time, I was conscious of the sounds of footsteps, and I swear to you that they came from somewhere in the air, though on a similar occasion, I felt them beneath. Not a man's step, but something larger making them. It is at approximately these times that we find wet doorknobs, and the whole house gives off a strange fish-like odor that seems strongest just outside my father's rooms. In any ordinary case, I would have dismissed what Eldon has said as the result of some illness unknown to him as well as to me. But to tell the truth, one or two things he had said stirred to life chords of memory which had only begun to bridge the abyss between the prosaic present and that pastime, in which I had become familiar with certain aspects of life, on the dark side, so to speak. So I said nothing, trying to think of what it might be I sought in the channels of my memory, but failing, though I recognized the connection between Eldon's narrative and certain ghastly and forbidden accounts hidden in the library at Miskatonic University. "You don't believe me?" he accused suddenly. "I neither believe nor disbelieve for the present," I replied quietly. "Let's sleep upon it." "But you must believe me, Dave. The only alternative I have is my own madness." "It isn't so much a matter of belief as it is some reason for the existence of these things. We shall see. Before we go to bed, tell me one thing. Do you know whether you alone are affected by these things? Or does Ambrose experience them too?" Eldon nodded quickly. "Of course he does. He wanted to leave, but we've been unable to dissuade him so far." "Then you needn't fear for your sanity," assured him. "Now, then for bed." My room, as always when I stayed in the house, adjoined Eldon's. I bade my cousin good night and walked down the hall in the darkness, entering my room with some anxiety about Eldon occupying my thoughts. It was this anxiety which accounted for my slow reaction to the fact that my hand was wet. I noticed this at the moment I reached up to take off my coat. I stood for a moment staring at my gleaming hand before I remembered Eldon's story. Then I went at once to the door and opened it. Yes, the outer doorknob was wet. Not only was it wet, but it gave off a strong smell of aquatic life, that same fish-like odor which Eldon had just only a few moments past spoken. I closed the door and wiped my hand, puzzled. Could it be that someone in the house was deliberately plotting against Eldon's sanity? Surely not, for Ambrose had nothing to gain by such a course. And so far as I had been able to ascertain over the years, there was no animosity whatever between my uncle Asa and Eldon. There was no one else who might be guilty of such a campaign of fright. I got into bed, troubled still and trying to bridge the distance between the past and present. What was it happened at Innsmouth almost 10 years ago now? What was it lay in those shunned manuscripts and books in Miskatonic University? That I must see them, I knew. So I resolved to return to Arkham as soon as possible, still trying to search my memory for some clue to the solution of the night's events. I fell asleep. I hesitate to chronicle what took place shortly after I slept. The human mind is unreliable enough at best, let alone in sleep or just after, when the mental processes are clogged by sluggishness resulting from sleep. But in the light of subsequent events, the dream of that night takes on a clarity and reality which I would have thought possible of nothing in the strange half-world of sleep. For I dreamed. I dreamed almost immediately of a great vast plateau and a strange sandy world which bore some resemblance to the high plateau of Tibet or the Hanan country I had once visited. In this place the wind blew eternally and singularly beautiful music fell upon my ears. And yet that music was not pure, not free of evil, for always there was an undercurrent of sinister notes, like a tangible warning of tribulation to come, like the grim fate notes of Beethoven's Fifth Symphony. The music emanated from a group of buildings on an island in a black lake. There all was still, figures stood unmoving, strange-faced beings in the guise of men, some curious hybrid Chinese standing as if on guard. Throughout this dream it seemed as if I moved with the wind high above, a wind that never ceased. How long I was there I could not say, for I dreamed endlessly. Presently I was away from this place. I looked down from high above the sea upon another island where stood great buildings and idols, where again were strange beings, few of them in the guise of men, and again that deathless music sounded. But here also was something more. The voice of that thing, which had but recently in time talked to my uncle Asa. The same weird undulation emanating from deep within a squat building whose cellars must certainly have been inundated by the sea. For only a brief time, I looked upon this island, while from somewhere within me I knew its modern name, Easter Island. Then I was gone, held above the frozen fastness of the far north, looking down upon a secret Indian village where natives worship before idols of snow. Everywhere was wind, everywhere music, and the sound of that whistling voice, like a prologue to terror, a warning of incredible and awful evil soon to flower. Everywhere the voice of primeval horror shrouded and hidden beneath beautiful, unearthly music. I woke soon after, unbearably tired, and lay with eyes open staring into the darkness. Slowly I emerged from somnolence, and slowly I became conscious that the air in my room was heavy, laden with the fish-like odor of which Eldon had spoken. And at the same time, I was aware of two other things: the sound of retreating footsteps and the fading undulation I had heard, not only in my dreams, but in my uncle's room, only a few hours ago. I jumped from bed and ran to the window, looking eastward, but there was nothing to be known save that the sound seemed certainly to emanate from the vast ocean beyond. I crossed my room again and went out into the hall, where the smell of aquatic life was much stronger than it was in my room. I knocked gently on Eldon's door, and receiving no answer, entered the room. He lay on his back, his arm flung out and his fingers working. That he still slept was evident, though at first I was deceived by the whispered words coming from his lips. In the act of awaking him, I paused, hand outstretched, and listened. His voice was for the most part too low in pitch to carry well, but I did catch several words spoken apparently with greater effort to be clear. Yo Igor, Ithaqua, Cthulhu. These words were repeated several times before I caught hold of Eldon's shoulders and shook him. His awakening was not swift, as it should have been, but sluggish, uncertain. Only after a full minute did he become aware of me, but from the moment of that recognition he was his usual self. He sat up, conscious at the same time of the odor in the room and the sounds beyond. "You see," he said gravely, as this was all the confirmation I now needed. He got out of bed and went over to the window, standing there to look out. "Did you dream?" I asked. "Yes, and you?" We had had substantially the same dreams. Throughout his narrative about his dreams, I became conscious of movement on the floor above, furtive, sluggish movement, carrying with it sounds as of something wet sloshing across the floor. At the same time, the undulation beyond the house faded away, and the sounds of footsteps, too, came to a stop. But there was now, present in the atmosphere of the house, such an air of menace and horror that the cessation of these sounds contributed little to our peace of mind. "Let's go up and talk to your father," I suggested abruptly. His eyes widened. "Oh, no, we won't dare disturb him. He's given orders." But I was not to be daunted. I turned alone and went up the stairs, where I paused to knock peremptorily on Uncle Asa's door. There was no reply. I came to my knees and looked into the room through the keyhole, but I could see nothing. All was dark. But someone was there, for voices came out occasionally. The one was clearly Uncle Asa's, but strangely guttural and grasping, as if it had undergone some vital change. The other was like nothing I had ever heard before or since. A deep, throaty sound, a croaking, harsh voice, somber with menace. And while my uncle spoke in intelligible English, his visitor quite evidently did not. I set myself to listen, and heard first my uncle's voice. "I will not!" The unreal accents of the thing in the room with him sounded beyond the door. "Shub Niggurath!" There followed a succession of rapid mouthings as if in violent anger. "Cthulhu will not take me into the sea. I have closed the passage." "Violence again," answered my uncle, who seemed, however, to remain unafraid despite the significant change in the caliber of his voice. "Nor Ithaqua come in the wind. I can foil him too." My uncle's visitor spat a single word, "Yogyor," and there was no reply from my uncle. I was conscious of a subtle undercurrent of terror, quite apart from the atmosphere of menace that pervaded the old house. This was because I had recognized in my uncle's speech the same words spoken but a few moments ago by Eldon in his sleep, and understood that some malign influence was at work in the house. Moreover, there began to drift back into my mind certain memories of strange narratives brought back across the years from a time when I had delved into the forbidden texts at Miskatonic University. Weird, incredible tales of ancient gods, of evil beings older than man. I began to dwell upon the terrible secrets concealed in the Noptic manuscripts, in the Rilia texts, those vague, suggestive stories of creatures too horrible to contemplate in the prosaic existence of today. I attempted to shake myself free of the cloud of fear that insidiously overcame me, but there was that in the atmosphere of the house to make this impossible. Fortunately, the arrival of my cousin Eldon did what I myself could not do. He had crept up the stairs behind me, and now stood waiting for some move on my part. I motioned him forward and told him what I had heard. Then we bent to listen together. There was no longer the sound of conversation, but only a sullen, unintelligible muttering accompanied by the growing sound of footsteps, or rather, of sounds which, by their spacing, might have been footsteps, but were made not by any creature similar to my ears by its sounds, but by something which seemed at every step to be walking into a bog. Now there was, too, a faint inner trembling in the old house, a strange and natural shuddering, which was neither decreased nor increased, but continued until the sounds of footsteps ceased, fading into the distance. During all this time, no sound had escaped us. But when the footsteps crossed the room behind the door and went on into space beyond the house, Eldon caught his breath and held it until I could hear the blood pounding in his temples bent close to mine. "Good God," he burst out at last, "what is it?" I did not trust myself to answer, but had begun to turn slightly to make some kind of reply, when the door opened with a suddenness that left us both speechless. My uncle Asa stood there. From behind him on all sides came an overpowering smell, as of fish or frogs, a thick miasmic odor of stagnant water so powerful that it brought me close to nausea. "I heard you," my uncle said slowly. "Come in." He stepped aside and we entered the room, Eldon still somewhat reluctant. The windows in the opposite wall were wide open. At first the dim light disclosed nothing, for it was itself as if shrouded in fog. Presently it was evident that something wet had been in the room, something that gave off a heavy vapor, for walls, floors, furniture, all were covered with a heavy dew, and here and there on the floor stood pools of water. My uncle did not appear to notice, or accustomed to it, had forgotten about it. He sat down in his armchair and looked at us, motioning us to seats before him. The vapor had begun almost imperceptibly to lift, and Uncle Asa's face grew clearer to my eyes. His squat head even deeper in his body now, his forehead gone entirely. His eyes half closed, so that his resemblance to the frogs of our childhood days was marked, a grotesque caricature, horrible in its implications. With only the slightest hesitation, we sat down. "Did you hear anything?" he asked. But without waiting for an answer, he went on. "I suppose you did. I have thought for some time I must tell you, and now there may be little enough time left. But I may deceive them yet. I may escape them." He opened his eyes and looked at Eldon. He did not seem to me at all. Eldon leaned forward a little anxiously, for it was evident that something troubled the old man. He was not himself. He seemed only half present, with his mind still wandering in some far place. "The Samhain compact must end," he said in a guttural voice, not like that I had heard in the room. "You will remember that. Let no other Samhain be in bondage to those creatures." "Did you ever wonder where our income came from, Eldon?" he asked suddenly. "Why, yes, often," Eldon managed to reply. "And it's been that way for 3 generations, my grandfather and my father before me. My grandfather signed my father away, and my father signed me away. But I shall not sign you away. Never fear. This must be its end. So they will not allow me to go naturally as they did grandfather and father. They will take me before instead of waiting. But you will be free of them, Eldon. You will be free. Father, what is it? What's the matter? He did not appear to hear. Make no compact with them, Eldon. Shun them, avoid them. Evil is their heritage, such evil as you cannot know. These are things you are better without knowing. Who was here, Father? Their servant. He did not frighten me. Nor of Cthulhu am I afraid, nor Ithaqua, in whom I have hidden high over the face of the earth, over Egypt and Samarkand, over the great white silences, over Hawaii and the Pacific. But Logair, who can draw the body from the earth piecemeal. Logair, with his twin brother Zar, and the horrible Chocho people who tend them in the high plateaus of Tibet. Of him, he paused abruptly and shuddered. They have threatened me with his coming. He took a deep breath. Let him come then. My cousin said nothing but looked his distress. What is this compact, Uncle Asa? I asked. And you will remember, he went on, oblivious to my question, how your grandfather's coffin was kept shut and how light it was. There's nothing in his grave, only the coffin, and in your great-grandfather's too. They took them. They have them. Somewhere they have given them unnatural life, a soulless life. For nothing more than our sustenance, the small income we have had, and the knowledge they gave us of their hideous secrets. It began, I think, in Innsmouth. My grandfather met someone there, someone who, like him, belonged to those creatures who came up, frog-like, out of the sea. He shrugged and glanced once briefly towards the window on the east, where now fog slow glowed whitely and the sound of the sea rose distantly, the long roll and murmur of water. My cousin was about to break the silence that had fallen when another question, when Uncle Asa turned once more to us and said briefly, curtly, "Enough now, leave me." Eldon protested, but my uncle was adamant. By this time I needed little further enlightenment. The stories I had heard about Innsmouth, the Tuttle affair on the Aylesbury Road, the strange knowledge concealed in those shunned texts at Miskatonic University, the not Coptic manuscripts, the Book of Ibon, the Rilia text, and darkest of all, the dread Necronomicon of the mad Arab Abdul Azared. All these things revived long-forgotten memories of potent, evil, ancient ones, elder beings of incredible age, old gods who once inhabited not only Earth but the entire universe, who were divided between forces of ancient good and forces of ancient evil, of which the latter, now in leash, were yet greater in number, if not in power. Most ancient of all, the elder gods, the forces of good, were nameless, but weird and terrible names identified the others. Cthulhu, leader of the elemental water powers. Hastur, Ithaqua, your Igor, who led the forces of air. Yog-Sothoth, and Sothaqua of earth. It was now apparent to me that three generations of Sanwans had made a hideous compact with these beings. A compact that promised surrender of soul and body in return for the great knowledge and security in the natural life of the Sanwins. But the most ghastly aspect of this compact was the obvious indication that each generation swore away the succeeding generation. My uncle Asa had at last rebelled, and he now awaited the consequences. Once more in the hall, Eldon put a hand on my arm and said, "I don't understand." I shook his arm off almost roughly. "Nor I, Eldon. But I've some idea, and I want to get back to the library and verify it." "You can't go now." "No, but if nothing happens for a day or so, I'll go. I'll come back later." We spent an hour or so in Eldon's room, talking all around the trouble and listening almost morbidly for evidence of further activity above. But there was nothing. And presently I returned to bed, almost as ill at ease for the lack of strange sounds and odors as I had previously been at their happening. The remainder of the night passed uneventfully, and so did the next day, during all of which my uncle Asa did not come from his room. The second night passed quietly also, so that on the following day I returned to Arkham, welcoming the sight of the ancient gambrel roofs and Georgian balustrades as the face of home. In a fortnight I returned to Sanwyn House, but nothing more had happened. I saw my uncle briefly and was astonished at the change in his aspect. He had grown to look more and more Bactrian, and his body seemed to have shrunk a little. He made some effort to conceal his hands, but not before I had seen a peculiar transformation there, a curious growth of skin from finger to finger, the significance of which did not at first dawn on me. I asked him once what more he had heard from the visitors of that night 2 weeks ago. "I'm waiting for Yug Igor," he said cryptically, his eyes fixed beadily on the east windows and a grimness about his mouth. In this hiatus I learned more about the dead secrets of the elder gods and the beings of evil they had long ago banished to the hidden places of earth, the Arctic wastes, the desert land, the Shun Plateau of Leng in the heart of Asia, the Lake of Hali, the vast and remote caverns under the seas. I had learned enough to be convinced of my uncle's hideous compact, the pledge of body and soul to serve the spawn of Cthulhu and Yog-Igor among the Chochos people in remote Tibet, to serve them in afterlife in their constant struggle against the domination of the elder gods, the seals put upon them by the retreating ancient ones, the struggle to rise again and spread horror throughout earth. That my uncle's father and grandfather were even now so serving in some distant fastness I could not reasonably doubt, for evidence of evil activity was all about me, not alone in tangible things, but in the incredibly strong aura of intangible terror that held the house in siege. On the second visit, I found my cousin somewhat reassured, but still waiting half fearfully for something to happen. I could not stir him to any hope, but must perforce reveal to him some of the things I had verified in the ancient and forbidden books reposing in the vaults of Miskatonic. On the night preceding my departure, while we sat a little uneasily in Eldon's room waiting for something to happen, the door was suddenly opened and my uncle came in, walking with a strange halting gait unnatural to him. He seemed somehow to have grown smaller too, now that I saw him on his feet and his clothes bagged on him. "Eldon, why don't you go into Arkham with David tomorrow?" he said, without preamble. "A little change will do you good." "Yes, I'd like to have him," I said. Alden shook his head. "No, I'll stay to see what nothing happens to you, Father." Uncle Asa laughed brittily, and I thought with a faint sneer, as if to deprecate anything Eldon might attempt to do. If Eldon did not understand his father's attitude, it was clear enough to me, since I knew more than Eldon something of the power of the primeval evil to which my uncle had become allied. My uncle shrugged then. "Well, you're safe enough unless you're frightened to death." "I don't know." "You expect something to happen soon, then?" I asked. The old man gave me a searching glance. "It is clear that you do, David," he said thoughtfully. "I expect your Igor, yes. If I'm able to fight him, I shall be free of him. If I am not," he shrugged and added, "then I think Sanwyn House will be free of this accursed cloud of evil that has shrouded it for so long." "There is a time," I asked. His glance did not waver, but his eyes narrow a little. "When the full moon rises, I think, if my computations are correct, Arcturus must also be above the horizon before Lo-Igor can come in on his cosmic wind. For being a wind elemental, he will travel as wind. But I will be waiting for him." He shrugged once more as if he were dismissing some trivial event instead of the grave threat to his life that was inherent in his words. "Very well then, Eldon. Do as you wish. He left the room and Eldon turned to me. Can't we help him fight this thing, Dave? There must be some way. If there is a way, your father knows it. He hesitated for a long minute before he spoke of something evidently on his mind for some time. Did you notice Father's appearance? How he seems to have changed? He shuddered. Like a frog, Dave. I nodded. There is some relation between his aspect and that of the creatures with whom he has become aligned. There was something of this in Innsmouth, too. People who bore strange resemblance to the inhabitants of Devil Reef before the reef was bombed. You must remember it, Eldon. He said no more until I spurred him on by telling him that he must keep in touch with me by telephone. That may be too late, Dave. No, I'll come at once. At the first sign of anything amiss, call me. He agreed, and he went to bed for a restless but quiet night. The April moon reached its fullest at approximately midnight on the night of April 27th. Long before that time, I was ready for Eldon's telephone call. Indeed, more than once in the late afternoon and early evening hours, I had the impulse to go to Sandwyn House without waiting for Eldon to call. But I resisted. At 9 o'clock that night, Eldon called, oddly enough. I had just become cognizant of Arcturus standing over the roofs of Arkham in the east, its amber light glowing brightly despite the brilliance of the moon. That something had happened, I knew. For Eldon's voice shook, his voice, and his words were clipped. He was eager to say what must be said, and that was that I should come without delay. For God's sake, Dave, come! He said no more. He needed to say no more. Within a few minutes, I was in my car speeding up the coast towards Sandwyn House. The night was quiet, windless. Killdeers and whippoorwills were calling, and an occasional nighthawk swooped and sky-coasted within the glow of my car's lights. The air was fragrant with the smell of growing things, the rich aroma of turned earth and early foliage, of swampland and open water, all in direct contrast to the horror that clung tenaciously to mind. As before, Eldon met me in the yard at Sandwyn House. I had no sooner got out of my car than he was there beside me, greatly distraught, his hands trembling. "Ambrose has just gone," he said. "He went before the wind started, because of the whippoorwills." As he spoke, I was conscious of the whippoorwills, scores of them calling from all around, and I remembered the superstition believed by so many of the natives, that at the approach of death the whippoorwills, in the service of evil, called for the soul of the dying. Their crying was constant, unceasing, rising most steadily and loudly from the meadows west of Sandwyn House, but sounding to some degree all around. A kind of maddening outcry for the birds seemed close, and the cry of a whippoorwill, nostalgic and lonely at a distance, multiplied many times and placed nearby, becomes a harsh, shrill call, difficult to tolerate for long. I smiled grimly at Ambrose's flight. I remembered Eldon saying he had gone before the wind began. The night was windless still. "What wind?" I asked abruptly. "Come in." He turned and led the way swiftly into the house. From the moment that I stepped across the threshold of Sandwyn House that night, I entered another world, remote from that I had just left. For the first thing of which I was cognizant was the high rushing sound of great winds. The house itself seemed to tremble under the impact of tremendous forces from without, and yet I knew, having just come in from outside, that the air was quiet, that no wind blew. The winds, then, sounded within the house, from the upper stories, those quarters occupied by my Uncle Asa, those quarters linked physically, psychically, to the incredible evil with which he had become allied. In addition to this incessant rushing of wind, there came as from a great distance that shudderingly familiar undulation, striking in from the east, and at the same time the sound of gigantic footsteps, the soggy, wet footsteps, accompanied by an undeniable sucking noise that seemed to emanate from somewhere beneath us, and yet beyond the house itself, beyond even terrestrial earth as we knew it. This, too, from some psychic source, this, too, was a manifestation of those evil beings with whom the Sandwinds had made the ghastly compact. "Where's your father?" I asked. "In his rooms. He won't come out. The door's shut, and I can't go in." I went up the stairs towards the door to my uncle's quarters, with the intention of opening that door by force. Alden came protestingly behind. It was no use, he assured me. He had tried it and failed. I was almost upon the door when I was stopped in mid-stride by an impassable barrier. Nothing of substance, but a wall of cold, chilling air, beyond which I could not go, no matter how much I tried. "You see," cried Alden. I tried and tried again to reach through the impassive wall of air towards the door, but I could not. Finally, in desperation, I called out to Uncle Asa, but no human voice answered me. I was not answered at all, save by the roaring of great winds somewhere beyond the door, for strong as the winds had sounded in the lower hall, in the quarters occupied by my uncle the sound of them was incredibly powerful, and it seemed as if at any moment the walls must fly asunder by a terrific force that were unleashed there. Throughout all this time, the sound of footsteps and the undulation too were growing in magnitude. They were approaching the house from the direction of the sea, if such an occurrence were possible, in the light of their seeming already there, a part of the unholy aura of evil in which Sanwyn House was cloaked. Simultaneously with the approach of these sounds from the water, there struck into our consciousness another sound from high above us, a sound so incredible that Alden looked at me and I at him, as if we had not heard right. It was the sound of music and of voices singing, rising and falling, alternately clear and vague. But in a moment we understood the source of that music, as the same from which had come that weirdly beautiful music we had heard in our dreams in Sanwyn House. For the music, on the surface of it so beautiful and ethereal, abounded with hellish undertones. It was such music as the sirens might have sung to Ulysses. It was as beautiful as the Venusberg music, but perverted by evil that was horribly manifest. I turned to Alden, who stood wide-eyed and trembling behind me. "Are there any windows open?" "Not in Father's room. He worked at that the past few days." He held his head cocked to one side and suddenly gripped my arm. "Listen!" There arose now from beyond the door a growing undulation accompanied by a ghastly gibbering from among which certain words were audible. Certain horrible words, only too familiar to me from sight of them in those forbidden books at Miskatonic University. The sounds of those creatures bound in unholy alliance to the Sandwinds, the evil mouthing of these hellish beings, long ago banished to outer spaces, to remote places of earth and universe by the elder gods on distant Betelgeuse. I listened with mounting horror, made all the greater by knowledge of my impotence, and tinged now with a certain nameless fear for my own existence. The mouthings beyond the door mounted in intensity with occasionally a sharp sound that must have been made by someone different from them. Their own voices were clear, however, rising and falling, even as music still sounded distantly, as if a group of servants were singing their adoration for their master, a hellish chant, a triumphant undulation. There was a brief lull, during which some voice came, as if in answer, a harsh frog-like croaking of words unintelligible to me, in a voice whose harsh sound still bore some overtones vaguely, arrestingly familiar to me, as if somewhere before I had heard certain of these inflections. This harsh croaking came more and more hesitantly, the gutturals apparently failing the speaker, and then once again rose that triumphant undulation, that maddening chorus of voices from beyond the door, accompanied by such a feeling of dread horror that no words can describe it. Trembling violently, my cousin held out his arm to show me that his wristwatch indicated but a few minutes before midnight, the hour of the full moon. The voices in the rooms before us continued to rise in intensity, and the wind rose, so that it was as if we stood in a raging cyclone. At the same time, the harsh croaking voice resumed again, mounting in intensity until abruptly it changed into the most awful wailing man ever heard, the crying of a lost soul. the demon-written scream of a soul lost for all time. It was then, I think, that realization came to me, that I knew and recognized the harsh croaking voice as not one of my uncle's hellish visitors at all, but the voice of Uncle Asa. At the moment of this ghastly recognition, which must have come to Eldon at the same time the sounds beyond the door rose to unbearable shrillness, the demonic winds thundered and roared, my head whirled, I clapped my hands to my ears. So much I remember, and then nothing more. I awoke to find Eldon bending over me. I was still in the upper hall, lying on the floor before the entrance to my uncle's quarters, and Eldon's pale, luminous eyes were peering anxiously into mine. You fainted, he whispered. So did I. I started up, startled by the sound of his voice that seemed so loud, though it had been but a whisper. All was still. No sound disturbed the quiet of Sanwyn House. At the far end of the hall, the moonlight lay in a parallelogram of white light, lending a mystic illumination to the darkness all around. My cousin looked towards the door to my uncle's quarters, and I went forward unhesitatingly and yet afraid of what we might find behind it. The door was still locked. We finally had to break it down. Eldon struck a match to relieve the deep darkness of the rooms. I don't know what Eldon expected to find, but what we found was far beyond even my most fearful expectation. Even as Eldon had said, the windows had been boarded up so securely that not a single ray of moonlight penetrated the rooms, and on the sills had been laid a strange collection of five-pointed stones. But there had been one point of entrance my uncle had evidently forgotten, the attic window, though this was closed and locked save for a tiny break in one pane. The course of my uncle's visitors had been unmistakable, a wet trail leading into the quarters from the trapdoor near the attic window. The rooms were in frightful condition. No single thing remained intact, save the chair in which my uncle habitually sat. It was indeed as if a powerful gale had torn asunder papers, furniture, hangings with equal malevolence. But it was my uncle's chair to which our attention was directed, and what we saw there was all the more frightful in its significance, now that the tangible aura of horror had been removed from Sanwyn House. The trail leading from the trapdoor and attic window went directly to my uncle's chair and back again, a strange shapeless procession of marks, snake-like, some of them the prints of webbed feet, which most curiously seemed to emanate from the chair in which my uncle had been wont to sit, and pass outward. All led back to that tiny break in the pane of the attic window. Something had come in, and something more had gone out. Incredible, terrible, awful to contemplate what must have taken place while we lay beyond that door. What must have wrung from my uncle that terrible wailing we had heard before we lapsed into unconsciousness. For of my uncle there was no trace save one, the ghastly remnants of what stood for him rather than of him. In the chair, his favorite chair, lay his clothes, not taken off and flung carelessly down, not that, but in the horrible lifelike position of a man sitting there, fallen a little together, from cravat to shoes, the terrible mockery of a man sitting there, but they were empty, a shell about which clung an abysmal clothing shaped by some ghastly power beyond our comprehension, into the effigy of the man who had once worn them, the man who by all the evidence was drawn or sucked out of them as by some frightful malign being who employed in his aid the terrible wind heard within the rooms, the mark of Lo'Igor, who walks the winds among the star spaces, the terrible Lo'Igor, against whom my uncle had had no weapons.